Good morning and welcome to the second day of the May session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I'm Mike Pirtle from Omaha and I'm pleased to be joined today on my right by Judge Francie Reedman of Gretna and on my left by Judge Rico Bishop of Lincoln. We only have one case on our call this morning. Before we begin, I just ask the appellees, has there been some discussion about splitting the 10 minutes? With that, we can begin. In re guardianship of Amy S. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. This time I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. Your Honor, Bren Kuhn Law, on behalf of Deborah Sadowski and June Berger in this case. This case is about a mother who is trying to get the best possible care for her daughter, who was determined incapacitated in 2001. She served as guardian for her daughter from 2001 to 2011, when she relinquished that role and responsibility due to an incident that occurred. After her relinquishment, a guardian was appointed by the court, a disinterested third party, a woman by the name of Sally Heitrek, who's a practicing attorney, to care for Ms. Sadowski, for Amy Sadowski. Ms. Sadowski was put in a nursing home. She's 39 years old, this woman, and she was put in a nursing home out in Seward County, Nebraska, where she currently resides today. It was a big concern for the mother of this child that her daughter was not being given the proper care that she felt that she deserved as an incapacitated individual under the care of a disinterested third party. In this particular case, I think probably what speaks more of her, gives more rise to her concern than anything else are the photographs that you can see the difference between what her condition was when she was just in a residential care facility or just out of the residential care facility, exhibit number 61, which was received at the hearing in 2017, and how she looked later when she was in the care of the guardian that was appointed by the court, exhibits number 63 through 73, and how her appearance had substantially changed.
Would that be pertinent to the current guardian?
That would be pertinent to the current guardian as well, because it's our feeling that there hasn't been any change with respect to her condition at the present time. She continues to be isolated in this facility. She continues to have the same issues. She continues to have issues with regard to her appearance and having outside contacts and everything else.
So the facility is a problem?
Well, it's not just the facility, it's the fact that you have a 39-year-old woman who's being placed in a facility that is for old age people who are basically getting ready to die. She's 39 years old, and she's a young person, and under our statutes for guardianships, the unicameral has made it clear that when it comes to caring for wards, it's the responsibility of the guardians to make sure that those wards receive the best possible care, and that whatever limitations are placed upon them, that they be restrictive only to what's necessary to provide for them the proper care. And that's what the issue is in this case.
Were other facilities proposed?
There weren't other facilities proposed at that point in time, because what Ms. Sadowski was doing was she was coming in and saying, look, I don't see that proper care is being provided by this guardian. I'm the mother of this child. There isn't anyone that has a greater interest in seeing to the best of her care than her own biological mother.
But when the child, when the woman was under the care of her mother, and the mother as guardian, weren't there some serious issues at
there
that
was
a, time?
There was one serious incident, but keep in mind, she was appointed as guardian in 2001 and served in that capacity without incident until 2011. In 2011, there was a serious incident. There was an incident because there was no residential care available for wards at that time. She was living in an apartment where her mother was then coming in and providing care for her on a daily basis. And other individuals were assisting her in that regard. And she had an incident, not due to anything that Ms. Sadowski, Deborah Sadowski had done, but the fact that we're dealing with a person that has mental health issues. These are Amy's problems, not Debbie's problems.
And had not showered in 2 years?
What's that?
And had not taken a shower in 2 years?
Well, the fact...
That's not a problem.
Well, it is, but keep in mind also that this is a person that is under the care of a psychiatrist. She was supposed to be receiving care by a psychiatrist and properly being supervised. That psychiatrist didn't do anything in terms of when she had not come in for the appointments or anything of that nature. He did not try to do anything to assist her in that regard.
Shouldn't the guardian at that time, her mom, have been monitoring those appointments to make sure that they were being...
She was, attended? And she was trying to get her to go, but you had a person who doesn't see things the way we see things, or that the average person sees things because of their disability in this particular case.
Isn't that part of the issue now, though, and going forward? I mean, clearly there's a mom who loves her daughter and wants to provide care, but it's been determined that because of the kind of relationship there, there's maybe an inability to see outside that mother perspective where she wants to take care of her.
And I understand that that's what the other side wants the court to, you know, that's the position they would like the court to take, but there was never any evidence of that. There was never any evidence put on in terms of
other than
trial.
Looking at what happened in 2011. I mean, clearly her role as mom slash guardian was a conflict, right? Because as a guardian, she should have been able to see that there needed to be some intervention. And the question is, can she do that today?
And that's what we haven't gotten to. We have not ever gotten to an evidentiary hearing where we've gotten the opportunity to present that evidence. The other side wants to go back, and all they want to talk about is what happened in 2011. That's it. We want to talk about what happened, this one incident that took place, and as a result of that, she should be forever disqualified as serving as guardian for her daughter. But there were changes. There were changes, and there was evidence put on the record with respect to those changes, how she intended to approach the situation, what she had learned between 2011 and 2013 when she decided to petition the court for a co-guardian and co-conservatorship in this case for her daughter, because she recognized in that she was going to need assistance in that regard. She undertook the responsibility of trying to find facilities, trying to find doctor's care and medical care and mental health care for her daughter. Because again, one of the concerns that she had was the lack of continuity in the treatment. She's out there in a facility and being treated by one physician after another, after another, after another. And what she wants to see is she wants to see her daughter get some continuity with regard to her mental health treatment. As the staff changes at this facility, as the doctors who provide care at this facility come and go, her daughter remains there. And with her at the helm, her knowing the history from the time this child was born until the time that she started having these disabilities, she can then keep the doctors informed as to her history, her past, her medical care.
So these are very persuasive arguments that I'm sure you would have made if you got to trial. So your issue is really the granting of summary judgment.
Right. And essentially, I mean, a couple of things. One, the court should not have granted the summary judgment. I think from an evidentiary standpoint, the court made an error with regard to not receiving into evidence Dr. Cahill's affidavit, because instead of striking those paragraphs from the affidavit, I think 11 through 13, those paragraphs should have been received into evidence, and I think that those were sufficient to get over the hump with regard to a summary judgment. Is there a material fact in dispute between the parties that remains? And there was a material fact in dispute. You had Mr. Troyer and you had Dr. Peterson over here who are saying in their affidavit that there's an issue about her ability to serve in that capacity. You have an affidavit over here from Dr. Cahill, a PhD, saying, no, he's familiar with what's going on. He's been dealing with Ms. Sadowski for a period of time. He has the experience in terms of these kinds of issues, and he says that she's qualified to serve in that capacity. That is the material, or that is the issue in dispute. We now have a factual issue in dispute, and that never got to court. That we never got the opportunity to present that. We never got the opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses and the statements that they continue to make about Ms. Sadowski.
I think your argument in your brief is your position at summary judgment was to deal with competency, not best interest.
Correct. Because that's what they were attacking. They wanted her to have them. In all the years I've done this, I've never had a person file an application to be appointed as a guardian have to take a mental health evaluation. And that's what this particular judge did. She said, unless she was willing to concede to a mental health evaluation by Dr. Peterson, or which ultimately was performed by Dr. Peterson, that she was going to dismiss their application. So she went and had that done. If you look at the affidavit of Dr. Peterson, you will see that she clearly says that she's not forever disqualified. She just felt that she was not qualified at the time based upon the information that was known to her at that time. That's what we never got to do. We never got to cross-examine Dr. Peterson with regard to how she reached her opinion.
What does your client need to prove in order, because first you have to have the removal, correct, of the current?
Correct.
And what proof was necessary for removal?
You have to show that they're not providing the proper care and that it is in the best interest that this other individual or that they be appointed in that capacity. She has a priority under the statute to be appointed as a parent.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kathy Trent Villam and I represent the guardian ad litem, Kelly Turner. Before I get into the substance, I'd like to clarify a few things. In terms of this photo argument, I would point out to the court that these photos are several years old and certainly don't reflect the condition of Amy Sadowski in 2011. As much as Mrs. Sadowski would like to ignore what happened in 2011 and refer to it as a one-time incident, as Judge Pirtle pointed out, that was a two-year culmination. Her daughter was left in an apartment alone, screaming for hours to the point where the police were called. When they found her, she was malnourished, dehydrated, had not bathed for 2 years.
So she clearly needed some residential
she
care.
She clearly needed a more structured
care.
Environment.
But so that's where we are now.
That is where we are now.
And so the issue is really whether mom is capable now, in light of her daughter being in an assistance facility, can she provide that guardianship?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the question is whether or not the trial court erred in granting summary judgment, which is a very different question. The motion for summary judgment clearly showed that one of the issues that they were intending to seek summary judgment on was the question of whether or not it was in Amy's best interest to have her mother appointed as guardian or to have her existing guardian removed. Ms. Sadowski and her attorney opted to show up at the hearing, of which they had 3 weeks' notice, with a single affidavit of an expert who lacked sufficient information and foundation to even give an opinion on that question because he had no knowledge of Amy. Whether he had acted as her doctor years before, there was nothing in his affidavit that provided any foundational information that would have allowed him to opine what was in a third party's best interest. All he had was information that was provided to him by Ms. Sadowski. And based on the evidence that was presented to the court, clearly the information that Ms. Sadowski provided to third parties was skewed. For example, if you take Ms. Berger's testimony, she testified at the hearing on the fee application that she was told that the police came because Amy was being loud. There was no information told to her by Ms. Sadowski that she was also malnourished, that she had not bathed for several years, that her hygiene was abysmal, that her toenails had grown to the point where she was having difficulties walking. So certainly, the notion that this expert can rely solely on information of an interested third party who has a history of not disclosing adverse information, I think the trial court absolutely properly found that he had no sufficient foundation. Without those opinions coming into evidence, there was no other evidence to oppose the motion for summary judgment. To the extent that Ms. Sadowski now wants to make other arguments, well, I didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine them. The statute gives parties who are the non-moving party the right to ask the court for continuance if they believe that they need additional evidence in order to counter that summary judgment motion. There was no motion for a continuance made. There was no objection made to, hey, Judge, I haven't had an opportunity to depose Dr. Troyer or Dr. Peterson, and I'd like to do that before we go forward with the summary judgment hearing. He simply showed up with an affidavit, made a strategic decision, and that strategic decision did not work out, and now they want to cry foul. There's no reason why he couldn't have asked the court to continue the hearing, to allow him to put Ms. Sadowski on the witness stand, to offer affidavit testimony of Ms. Sadowski if he so chose.
Do you believe if Dr. Cahill's affidavit had been received by the court in its entirety, that would have cause the court to conclude that there was a material question of fact?
No, because Dr. Cahill's testimony was she competent to serve as a co-guardian? He never opined that she could serve or act as a guardian. And one of the things that I think they assume is that if you are able to serve as a co-guardian, that that qualifies you under statute to serve as a guardian. And as we say, two halves don't make a whole. The fact that she acknowledges that she was not in a position to actually serve as guardian on her home on her own, and that she needed the help and assistance of a co-guardian in order to meet Amy's needs, I think in and of itself should have disqualified her, notwithstanding the fact that she is a biological mother. But even above and beyond that, Dr. Cahill didn't testify that it was in Amy's best interest to have her mother serve as co-guardian. It was simply that she was competent to serve as co-guardian.
What evidence was presented, if any, as to the failures of the current guardian and why that guardian should be removed?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think there was any evidence of any failures by the guardian. I understand that they're taking the position that Ms. Sadowski was 39 years old and living in an old folks home, as they'd like to characterize it. But the fact of the matter is that when Ms. Sadowski was testifying at the hearing on the motion for fees and the Rule 20, Rule 11 type motion, she testified that she was also looking at nursing homes to place Amy in, and she acknowledged that the nursing home provided the kind of structure that her daughter needed. Never mind the fact that as much as they want to talk about her having been secluded and raising this issue that there was a criminal statutory violation because they were somehow secreting her away, keep in mind, she was a shut-in for 2 years while she was under her mother's care. She didn't see any doctors. She didn't see her therapist other than maybe twice in 2 years. She refused to leave the apartment. She refused to even bathe and take care of herself. So the notion that putting her into a structured environment where she's actually interacting with other people and has an entire team of people dedicated to her care is a fallacy.
Can you speak to the attorney fees, the $75,000 in attorney fees? Was there evidence as to what period of time those fees covered?
There was evidence as to the amount of time that those fees covered, and I believe those fees covered the vast majority of the time that they represented Ms. Turner. But again, the question is, did the court abuse its discretion in awarding those fees? And they've not presented any arguments to show that there was an abuse of discretion by the court in allowing that.
What about not having an opportunity on a motion to alter or amend to address that very issue?
Well, keep in mind, the motion to alter or amend, by the time the motion to alter or amend had come up for hearing, a different judge had taken the bench. So basically what Mrs. Sadowski was doing was asking a judge after the fact to make a decision as to whether or not the information that was presented to the prior judge was sufficient and whether it was satisfactory as a matter of law. To the extent that they were dissatisfied with that prior judge's ruling, they didn't have to file a motion to alter or amend. They could have simply filed a notice of appeal. There was nothing that required them to file a motion to alter or amend in order to seek some type of relief from that order. So the fact that the judge summarily denied it without having an actual hearing, I think was the proper situation considering the fact that she was being asked to review another judge's order after the fact on an evidentiary basis, where obviously the prior judge was in the best position to have witnessed any type of testimony, observe the witnesses, things of that nature. So it's really hard to ask another judge in a trial court setting, I think, to go back and relay all of that evidence. And in fact, the case law that they cite as to why they should have been given due process opportunities actually supports the notion that it would have been improper for the judge after the fact to try to go back and relay evidence and issue a judgment based on evidence that they did not individually hear.
What standard of review would the new trial judge have applied on that motion to alter amend?
I think it would have had to have been an abuse of discretion.
So you're saying it's inappropriate for that judge, but that's exactly what we do.
Right, but you're sitting as an appellate court. That is what you are doing. A trial court judge on a motion to alter or amend is not sitting as an appellate court judge, and it's not their role to determine whether or not another trial judge sitting in that position abused his or her discretion. So I think what they were really trying to do is get appellate relief by filing a motion to alter or amend with the trial court instead of simply filing the notice of appeal.
Not really appellate relief. I mean, they're coming in, a new judge is coming in place of the prior trial judge. They can change whatever they want. They have that inherent authority to do that. So I don't think there's an abuse of discretion standard there. They could look at the evidence and make that decision. Whether or not a hearing was necessary is the issue.
Well, but what you're... At that point, Your Honor, what you're really describing is basically scrapping the first hearing and having a whole second evidentiary hearing, because the case law says that a trial court judge can't reweigh and issue a judgment based on evidence that they did not hear. So what you're really saying is all of the work that the trial court judge did...
Was there not a record made?
I'm sorry?
Was there not a record made?
Well, there was certainly a record, but that's not the same thing as having the witnesses appear in front of you and having the opportunity to assess their credibility and observe them. And certainly, as sitting as the appellate court, you can appreciate the significance of that, because that's something that you guys frequently talk about in giving deference to the trial court, is the fact that they had that opportunity to make that review. There's one other thing that I would like to point out, and that is the jurisdictional issue. They filed the motion. May I?
Yes.
They
I mean,
filed.
It's your time. So, what is that? Your 10?
That
oh, I'm
ten.
Sorry. I thought that was.
The jurisdictional issue. I know that they've complained that motions for additional fees were filed, and that it's our position that those motions should have been heard. But again, to the extent that they wanted to seek appellate review of the order of the court on that 25-824 hearing, they could have simply filed a notice of appeal and removed that matter from the court's jurisdiction. They opted to basically keep that matter on the trial court's docket by filing a motion to alter or amend, in which case they should have anticipated that there would have been additional fee applications, as there had been all throughout the proceedings, and further that the court would have needed to address those in order for appellate jurisdiction to
lie. But those motions for fees came after judgment was entered.
They did come after judgment was entered, but they came before the order from which they are appealing.
Were any of those motions for attorney fees that were filed after the judgment motions for attorney fees for final or completed?
I believe that part of the time that those requested would have been the time that they spent doing the hearing on the motion for fees. So at the time that they had the evidentiary hearing, they presented evidence of the fees that they had incurred up until that point, but that would not have included the time that they'd spent on the actual hearing.
So those people are still incurring fees, or were still incurring fees.
Right, and so the fees are basically relating back to the issue that they're now appealing from. Thank you.
Okay. How far did we take her over? And how much time did the appellant have left? Okay, so add the time for your bottle, please.
You have about 2 minutes.
Thank you. In this particular case, keep in mind that in the case of In re Guardianship of Robert D., it makes it very clear that guardian ad litems do not have the authority to act as an adversary in these proceedings. So the action that was taken by the guardian ad litem, both with respect to the summary judgment hearing, in filing it, in proceeding on it, in making objections upon it, upon asking for attorney fees, it was outside the scope of what they were authorized to do at that time. I understand the statute changed, or there was an added statute in 2016 that changed that, but if not all or the majority of the attorney fees for which they were seeking was for attorney fees that were generated prior to that statute, and that statute was not retroactive that went into effect.
What makes you say the statute changed things as opposed to it simply set forth what the practice?
It basically said that guardian ad litems have authority to do more things than the In re Robert D. case indicated. Things that would be in the nature of an adversarial type of role, and to call witnesses and to do things, which In re up until that time, in the 2005 case of In re Robert D., the guardian ad litems didn't have the authority to do that. So she's coming in and saying, I want essentially $75,000 for my attorney for work that they did, which is outside the scope of what I'm allowed to do by case law as of that time. You're not entitled to get fees for work that is not authorized by law. And so therefore, the attorney's fee award should be vacated with respect to any fees that were generated prior to the time that the statute changed in 2016. in this particular case. And again, they didn't even have authority to file the summary judgment motion. They didn't have authority to make those objections that the court ultimately ruled in their favor. I mean, this was all done outside the scope of what they had authority to do.
Did you file any opposition to that effect with the trial court?
That was what we intended to take before the court. The issue on the motion to alter amend was not a factual one. It was a legal one. And the legal issue that was going to be presented, what I intended to present, and I indicated at a subsequent hearing I intended to present, and that was the issue of In re Robert D. They did not have authority to do the summary judgment. They did not have authority to do attorney's fees or recover attorney's fees.
Thank you. All right, thank you all for being here. We will take the case under advisement, and we are adjourned.